All right, Guillermo Mash with the Without a Roof Radio program, and we're real pleased to have Paul Bowden, a nationally recognized human and civil rights advocate and executive director at Western Regional Advocacy Project, dialing in from his home office in San Francisco. Welcome to KZFR, Paul Bowden.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, my pleasure, as always. Joining the conversation is Professor of Political Science, Jennifer Wilking, and Professor of Community Psychology, Mariah Kornbluh. And we also have Mariella. That's wonderful. I love that. I could say that all day. We also have Mariella Romas joining us from students. Welcome to KZFR, everyone.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
So today's topic of discussion is framed around research that Chico State University has undertaken to document the impacts of poverty and homelessness in Chico, with Paul Bowden providing historical perspective and the statewide view of legislation and laws targeted towards those without a roof. So the last time we talked, Jennifer, you guys had done a bunch of research. You've done some since. You know, where would you like to start as far as what you guys have done since we last talked in the fall?
Yeah, maybe I'll just give you a brief recap of what we've done since that last project, which focused on the implications of Chico's approach to homelessness, which has been a public safety approach centered around a sit light ordinance. In that study, we showed that arrests of individuals experiencing homelessness have increased and that the geography of those arrests have changed moving out of the downtown Chico area. Following up on that, we have a few research agendas planned in the next 2 years. This spring, we will do an extension of that project, looking at the types of crimes that are committed by whom, when, and where. So we're continuing to work with the Geographic Information Center. Next year, we're planning a project on health and homelessness, hopefully involving several stakeholders in town. And then in the spring of 2019, we hope to do a survey with an experiment embedded in the survey to understand the preferences of the housed population for different approaches to homelessness. So where they would like low-income housing located, for example, and what type of low-income housing the housed population would prefer, because this is really a critical piece in moving forward. So that's where we are with our research. But today, we're really fortunate to have Mariella with us to talk about a class that we've created to help with some of this research and to assist the community in projects like the next point in time count, which will be in January of 2019.
All right, Mariella, I guess that was a good segue for you. What's going on in this class? You got a big smile on your face, so
yeah.
I'm sure you're having fun.
Well, the psychology or the community psych class, we basically helped organize the surveys that we did for the point in time, the Make a Difference Day that we had going on last semester. Yeah, so we organized the questions and we basically tried to cater to whatever, you know, how do I say,
the community part.
Yeah, because we took into account like what the sheltered and unsheltered populations, you know, with regards to their experience, their current status, and basically just try to do our best to hear what they needed from the community. Yeah, so that was a pretty rewarding experience overall.
Any questions on your end, Paul, or maybe to kind of give some statewide perspective on this whole quote-unquote safety / criminalization of homelessness?
You know, we do our research in several different states simultaneously with the law schools of those states. So UC Berkeley Law School, Seattle University, Denver University, and in Oregon we did it with the ACLU. And in addition to that, just like Mariella was talking about, we did 1,600 surveys where we talked directly with homeless people about their experiences being impacted by those laws. And I think, you know, in any research and any organizing, you know, in order for it to be accountable, talking directly to the people that you're researching or that you're organizing with or that you're fighting for, that's the core of all of it. We use research and we're doing it on business improvement districts. We're doing it on fines and fees because homeless people, their first interaction and entrance into the criminal justice system, 9 times out of 10 is a ticket. A ticket then becomes a bench warrant when you don't pay it, and now you're in the criminal justice system and oftentimes ending up in jail. So in order to combat these things, in order to come up with strategies and approaches and ideas about how we can humanely address the issue of rampant poverty and visible homelessness, we have to include and listen to and document the experiences of the people that are actually being written about and talked about. And I just got to say, I think what you're doing there in Chico and the fact that it's early on, entering into a phase of talking directly to the homeless people, is going to make your research 10 times more valuable. And we couple it with the statewide research and the regional research and the national research. In our experience, you come to nothing ends homelessness like a home.
Mariah, any comments or questions for Paul?
Jumping off what you were saying there, Paul, from a teaching standpoint, a pedagogical standpoint, having our students have conversations with the homeless, not only soliciting rich data from that conversation, but it's also a really transformative experience for our students because they don't have opportunity to interact with the homeless. They see them in the community, but don't really have a starting point to have a conversation. So a lot of the students, while they were gathering data, were sitting and talking to the homeless and learning about their life stories as well. And for some of them, that was the first time they had ever interacted with that population. So wherever they go after school, hopefully they have at least that conversation in mind too. So I agree with you, definitely solicits really important data, and we have to get the homeless perspective on this issue. It also seems to really provide our students with a new experience understanding an issue firsthand from folks.
That's what we found with all of the students that we've worked with, and what I'm told from Denver and Seattle and UC Berkeley, why they want to keep working with us as an organization. And you know, it's a law school, right? So, of course, we put them on retainer. But a big part of why they want to keep engaging and keep building off of the original research is just that piece of it, that the students found it incredibly eye-opening and more enriching in the research they were doing to actually be connected to and talking to and engaged with the people that were the focus of the research they were doing. What do they call that, participatory research or something like that?
Participatory action research, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Or what we call in the poverty space, lived experiences. Mm-hmm.
Or we call it being accountable, but it's all the same. Yeah. You know, I don't care what you call it. It's so important. And with the academics, pedalology, and you learn all these words that are like, what the hell does that mean? But the process is what's important. And to engage with a community of people that you wouldn't normally have interactions with, it just adds so much value to the learning experience.
So what was your experience, Mariella, when you did that survey and spoke with folks downtown experiencing homelessness and poverty?
I would say my experience was very, like they said, eye-opening. The gentleman that I spoke to, he was from the Bay Area, kind of just came up to Northern California just because he had heard of Chico. He had tried Redding. He did not like it up there. So when he came down here, he said he really enjoyed the Chico community just because, for one, the students were very welcoming. The community as a whole was willing to help him out. You know, he knew that he didn't necessarily have a secure shelter, but he knew that community members were basically willing to help him out in his situation.
Let's dig in a little bit on this research, Jennifer. Yeah, I mean, you've got like a whole plan, I think, that goes out a couple of years.
This is continuing on what Paul is really interested in, is these laws that criminalize homelessness. And our first approach was the first take at the data. We're using arrest record data. And so we're limited a little bit in the data, but the first broad brush stroke was just to see what happened after CITLI was enacted. And then to see, you know, how the geography changed. But now when we're coding the specific statutes, we can get into some more of the micro trends in the data. And so one thing we're interested in exploring is how other changes in the community might affect where people are arrested, who is arrested, and for what. We're lucky to have had the Safe Space shelter in town over the winter months, the last 4 years. That shelter moves around from location to location every week. So we're interested in how crime is affected by the months that that shelter is open and where it's located. We're also interested in further exploring other changes, an increase in the staffing in the police department. That occurred at a certain time, what happened to arrests before and after that. We want to further understand and explore in more depth the impacts of CITLI and more importantly, how different approaches to homelessness might affect where and how many people are arrested who are experiencing homelessness. What we suspect and what we find in the literature, and Paul can jump in here with his experiences, but is that when you provide more shelter, you're likely going to see less crime. Paul, has that been your experience?
Yes, to the extent that standing, sitting, sleeping, and laying down are deemed crimes, which they are, unfortunately.
We're actually
looking...
You give
people alternatives to doing that in public space, and you're going to have a reduced police enforcement pattern. Absolutely.
We actually didn't even include that in the data because at the time that we were looking at the data, those weren't arrestable offenses. So what we found is that other crimes went up after sit-lie was enacted. And my suspicion is that was because police were interacting more with a homeless population and then would discover the bench warrants that you mentioned earlier. You know, with this further exploration of the data, we're going to be able to understand that mechanism better. Why did sit-lie lead to an increase in arrests when they couldn't be arrested for sitting or lying in public spaces?
And trying to find out what those bench warrants, what the offense was that led to the bench warrant, because in our experience, 10 times out of 10, the bench warrant is for not paying the ticket or fighting the mm-hmm. ticket in court, not whatever the original offense was. So unfortunately, you have to dig deep to find out, well, what was the ticket for then? What was the citation for? And that's where you come across this really inhumane policing pattern because, you know, UC Berkeley documented on a statewide level, violent offenses are way down.
Mm-hmm.
And public nuisance offenses are what they call vagrancy,
mm-hmm.
are way up. Like I'm talking 122% reduction in one category. Even public drunkenness offenses are down 60%. Mm-hmm. Isn't it ironic that sitting down on a sidewalk in a public space is deemed a criminal offense, or standing still is a criminal offense? And with our Right to Rest Act that we've been up now in Sacramento, we've had 25 meetings with different state legislative staff. We have yet to get a state representative who's willing to even introduce this bill so that we can have a hearing to look at police enforcement patterns and the obvious to us discriminatory enforcement that we're seeing.
Two things to add would be to the conversation. I was actually at all of the city council meetings back when Sit and Lie was passed, and I can remember the police department making that statement. Now with Sit and Lie, we'll physically be able to approach all these people for a misdemeanor offense and start questioning them. But I think before we turn it back to the in-studio audience, there was an excellent LA Times piece that just hit, I think, either Sunday Times or Saturday Times on this specific issue. And the title is Huge Increase in Arrest of Homeless in LA. And it talks exactly about what Paul Bowden was talking about, the quality of life crimes and bench warrants for people that failed to appear.
So, and it's so sad that we're having to grovel to talk about an enforcement pattern that is identical to anti-Okie laws and sundown town and Jim Crow laws. If everybody in our community that stood still in public space got a loitering ticket, loitering would have been an offense that was taken off the books the second day that it was on the books. But it allowed, by making it illegal to stand still, you allow the cops the discretion, they call it, to enforce this law in a discriminatory fashion.
We'd like to talk a little bit more about the class and what that looked like, because we hope to use this class in the future to assist with the point in time or other community needs around research around local homelessness. So Mariah is going to talk a little bit about what that class looked like.
Just to provide you with some context of the class, thanks, Jen. It involved a community psychology class, which was a capstone senior writing class, a class in the political sciences focused on research methods that Jen taught, and also our collaborator, Dr. Susan Roll, taught a class in social work focused on policy. So we had students with different interdisciplinary perspectives tackling this complex issue. And the class ended up surveying both folks that identified as having a home as well as folks who identified as homeless. So we got to participate in two communities, getting multiple perspectives on this issue. And students also volunteered their time at the Jesus Center and Esplanade House to better connect to the community and give back while we take research from the community to use it for social change and betterment as well. So I'll kick it over to Mariella to talk about some of the volunteer work she did and some of her findings even from the study as well.
So from the study, our group mainly focused on the lack of resources and basically what the homeless community needed from the sheltered community. And one of the biggest findings our group had was just the fact that women and other groups did not necessarily feel safe or didn't have that sense of comfort in order to answer the questions in the survey completely, like 100% truthful. just because I think that there's some identities that are tagged along with who they are that could lead to discrimination. And for the most part, they just don't feel safe, and which is very detrimental, I guess you could say, to the results, just because we are basing our questions, trying to cater to them to ask what they need. And if they're not, you know, giving that 100% truthful answer, then we don't really know what they need at that point. And with regards to the volunteer work that I did at the Esplanade House, is very eye-opening once again, just because everything that I was taught in our community psych class was basically applied. I saw what was going on, the types of families that are undergoing, you know, homelessness, poverty. And it's just great to know that our community has those kind of resources that are willing to help and just, you know, offer open arms to help them better their situation.
Just to go off of that, especially Mariella's point about why women might be availing themselves of certain services, one of the main questions and topics that the students chose to ask about in the study of individuals experiencing homelessness was barriers to receiving services or using the services that we have available. We do have services available. We don't have enough services available in town. Everybody's in agreement about that. But we also know that there are some people who are experiencing homelessness who don't use services that they could. So we tried to get at that. And one of the first questions we asked was, you know, do you feel comfortable using services in Chico? And over a majority of respondents said yes, they felt comfortable. And then we asked about specific services. Are you aware of those services? And then do you use them? And what we found in those questions was that there's a gap and that there's a lot of variation depending on the service. So there are some services a lot of people are very aware of, but then when you go to use of that service, you see a big drop. So that was certainly interesting. And then the students followed up. Obviously, we would want to know why that's the case. They asked questions about why you don't avail yourself of services or what are the barriers to services. You know, we had a list. Respondents could choose lots of different options, but the one that the most respondents selected was transportation or distance to the service was the biggest barrier. So that was really interesting and useful. I will couch all of this, though, by saying that this was a convenience sample. We surveyed 105 respondents downtown who are experiencing homelessness only in downtown on a Saturday morning. So it certainly doesn't represent the entire homeless population in Chico, but this still can be useful in helping us develop future research and in realizing, like Mariella and Mariah have been saying, that we may need to change our methodology next time. Maybe next time, instead of going for a bigger sample, we actually go for a smaller sample and allow more time to talk to individuals experiencing homelessness about specific issues to get more of that depth and nuance.
I thank everyone for joining. We're going to end with the Right to Rest Act, Paul, that needs to get a sponsor by the 16th, as I understand it.
Yeah, by the 16th of February, a week from Friday. We need to have somebody willing to put their name on it so that we can at least have a hearing. The bill's running in Colorado. It's run 9 times in Oregon, California, and Colorado collectively. The hearings have been amazing, and the service providers all talk about whether it's hard for people to get there or not. It always seems that there's waiting lists, and they're turning people away. And we know the answer to homelessness is a home. It was lack of housing that created homelessness, not lack of shelters. So while we humanely treat each other with compassion and dignity, we also need to stop the cycle of criminalization so that we can finally get to the crux of the matter, which is to restore the funding for affordable housing.
So this is an assembly bill that you're trying to get a sponsor
assembly
for?
Assembly or state senate. Either. One.
Okay.
Your state representative, your senate representative or your assembly representative, they should be at least allowing for people who are dealing with discriminatory police enforcement to have their day in a hearing to talk about this so that we can stop it once and for all. It's on our website, rathome.org.
Any other comments, Jennifer, before we close?
Yeah, I would just say, as a professor of political science, I completely support that idea of having a hearing so that everybody's voices can be heard. And, you know, we have certain interests that may be supporting certain laws like SITLAI, and those interests are generally more resource endowed and powerful than people who are experiencing poverty. So this is a great opportunity to widen the spectrum of debate. So I would just second Paul's call for people to talk to their representatives.
So, Paul, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how they could lobby their specific state assembly person or Senate?
Yeah,
Senator.
It's really easy. They all have a website, so you just Google their name, you'll see their website, and you call the Sacramento office or shoot them an email. You know, an email is probably more effective because then you get a response and then you have a name who to follow up with. And you just tell them that you know that we are out there asking for authors for this bill, Right to Rest Act 2018, and that you encourage your representative to submit it and turn it in for a hearing. They will respond. That's what's amazing about these guys. Whether they will actually author it and turn it in, who knows? But at least it's vitally important that they hear from the people they represent that this hearing is a worthwhile endeavor.
All right, for listeners just joining, we just wrapped up a conversation on the phone with Paul Bowden, nationally recognized human and civil rights advocate, executive director, Western Regional Advocacy Project, raphome.org. Along with two professors here at California State University at Chico, Jennifer Wilking, professor of political science, and Mariah Cohenblue, a professor of community psychology, along with Mariela Ramos, a student in the community psychology class. And I want to thank them all. And I want to thank you as listeners. And stay tuned, coming up right now, Non-Human Radio. And always, always remember, if you have a roof, be grateful.